Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, the District Court imposed severe sanctions on petitioners, the kind of sanctions that threaten reputations and careers for essentially this entire case. That was error because this entire case did have a good faith basis in true facts. It was just pled wrongly. The record is uncontroverted that Ms. Golikov...
Can the issue of the sanctions, both whether they were proper and the amount of the sanctions, can that be raised in an appeal from a final judgment, or is this the only shot?
It can't be raised for an appeal in a final judgment for a couple of reasons.
It cannot.
Sorry.
You're here on mandamus, right? So I have the same question.
Is this the only shot? Can this be raised later? I mean, the arbitration is completed, a judgment is entered, it comes up, and then you raise all of this.
I understand. I think practically the answer is no. And even if it could, this still satisfies the Bauman.
But how about legally? How about legally can it be?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I know practically it could not be.
Why do you say practically it could not be?
Let's play it out, Your Honor. This goes to arbitration. First of all, that wouldn't make sense for Ms. Golikov because the sanctions are against her counsel, and it'd be an arbitration over a bottle of avocado oil.
What's the status of the arbitration?
It hasn't been filed, Your Honor.
Has not been filed.
Has not been filed. Okay. Yeah. So it wouldn't make sense for her. It could settle, and I'm not sure if that might create a conflict then between Ms. Golikov and her counsel. If it was voluntarily dismissed, we couldn't ask Ms. Golikov to voluntarily dismiss it because then she'd lose her claim. And this court has held in that situation, it may not create appellate jurisdiction anyway when you voluntarily dismiss after a motion to compel arbitration just to create appellate jurisdiction. Then there's the Bauman factors, Your Honor. That would not address the ongoing harm, which this court found in the Tillman case, is ongoing harm to counsel's reputation and ability to practice as a...
Hey, let me ask you, the conflict between counsel and client at this point. So you're saying, I'm going to paraphrase, you tell me what I've missed. You're saying that at this point, counsel now has a sort of an independent vested interest in these sanctions that were imposed that may be potentially adverse to representing their client for settlement or other disposition of the case?
I don't think that's an actual conflict, Your Honor, because Ms. Golikov doesn't want to pursue an arbitration over a single bottle of avocado oil. It doesn't make sense for her to pursue anyway.
Well, but I thought you were saying that they would be disinclined to settle in a way that didn't account for the sanctions because, you know, this is a lot of money, and now they have sort of two targets to look at, one of which is self-serving. Is that what you're saying?
That Walmart would be disinclined
to settle? No, counsel for the plaintiffs. They now have a financial stake that may be adverse to their client's best interest. That's what I heard you saying. Is that what you're saying or not what you're saying?
Let me think it through carefully. I think that could potentially arise, and that's a reason it's not practical to pursue this arbitration. In addition, Ms. Golikov doesn't want to do it. It doesn't make sense for her, and it wouldn't.
Well, what I'm asking is, do you believe there's now an adverse interest between counsel and client because of these sanctions?
Not currently.
You don't?
Not currently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not currently.
Then what are you? Are you saying that could arise, that there could be a conflict later, or you just don't think there's one now?
I don't think there's one now. I do think it's hard to see a practical way that this case could go to arbitration in a way that makes sense for her and she doesn't want to, or that, you know, would actually result in a final judgment. An additional point, Your Honors, a final judgment wouldn't really change the record and the key issue before this court. I mean, the main issue here...
It would change the standard of review, make it less
difficult for you, Your Honor, but the Bauman factors are satisfied here. They are satisfied for mandamus, and they're satisfied because...
So once the mistake was discovered, Why didn't you just file an amended complaint that changes the November 14th date to a date where she made an in-store purchase? Boom, done. Everything's fixed. And then maybe, you know, you fight over what had happened, which was a mistake. But at that point, but instead double down on an error and generated a lot more trouble.
No, Your Honor, we petitioners didn't double down on the error after the mistake was discovered.
But why not just amend the complaint? You were basically making the argument that, well, there were other purchases, but that's not what the complaint said. The complaint was one purchase on one day, and it was inaccurately represented as being in a store. And it could have been fixed by an amendment of the complaint, and then maybe everything goes forward all right for you. But why wasn't that done?
It was done in response to the motion to decertify the class.
Was there a formal motion to amend the complaint?
The motion to decertify class asked for that relief.
But in a sentence, I think?
I'd have to look back, Yard. It may have been a couple sentences.
And that was after the arbitration motion was opposed, as if nothing had been wrong with the complaint. I mean, the decertification was like a year later, wasn't it?
Your Honor, the timeline was fast.
My recollection, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought the record said they went ahead and opposed arbitration even though they knew that the purchase record was completely misleading.
The arbitration motion was filed in May of 2025.
But isn't what I'm saying right? They opposed it, even though they knew at that point that they didn't have a leg to stand on for that purchase date.
No, I disagree. They did. When they opposed that, they did not say the complaint was correct. What they said is the complaint was incorrect, but Ms. Golikoff has in-store purchases.
No, my point is they still opposed arbitration and acted as if she had not made this online purchase that had bound her to arbitration in the first place.
No, Your Honor, they did not oppose arbitration for the online purchase. They did not. They opposed arbitration just for the in-store purchase.
Where in the record is the request for amendment of the complaint?
It's in the motion to decertify, Your Honor.
In the motion? Opposition to the motion.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Decertify.
You know, under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that's not a motion. You can't have a one-line statement in a brief in opposition to another motion and call that a motion. That doesn't work. That's not what the FRCP allows you to do. You can't do that. You can't say that's a motion. That's a comment in a brief opposing another motion.
If that is true, Your Honor, and I accept
it. Not if. It is true. Take my word for it. It's true.
I do, Your Honor, but the sanctions here were still air because it wasn't reckless. It didn't vexatiously multiply the
proceedings. Well, the point is they're speaking in a whisper and in an aside when they should be shouting, let us fix this. And they're not shouting, let us fix this.
They did shout, let us proceed on Ms. Golikoff's in-store purchases. I hear, Your Honor, that... And I take your word for it that they
Let me ask you a different question. Apparently, all these facts were known at least 5 days before the complaint was even originally filed. How under Rule 11, now I know that's not an issue here, but how even under Rule 11, when the attorney signed that complaint, they had a good faith foundation in fact and law when they knew the one receipt the entire case was based on was for an online purchase?
No, Your Honor, Ms. Cho did not know that. She failed to check it, and that was what the district court found.
Well, that's the point. She failed to check it. That means she was negligent and sloppy and should not have filed this case in the first place. That's why she got sanctioned.
Your Honor, negligence is not enough for 1927 sanctions. Gross negligence is not enough.
I understand that, but it's a mystery to me how any person would ever file a complaint with a receipt in hand and not actually look at it to determine whether it supported everything they were representing to the district court and launching years plus worth litigation with lots of money, expense, and aggravation for everyone. So
I understand,
how do you defend
that? I'm here to point out the fact that accepting what Your Honor is saying, and I hear Your Honor saying Your Honor believes I was negligent, that doesn't mean
it's not negligence. Don't get hung up on that. It's just...
That doesn't meet the 1927 standard. A helpful case on this point is actually a case Walmart cites, Caputo. In that case, Torres, one of the attorneys, repeatedly failed to verify a key fact, and then the court found a quadruple down on it. And the Ninth Circuit was not happy with that behavior, but it didn't satisfy the extremely high 1927 standard for sanctions. And so the sanctions were reversed, even though the Ninth Circuit expressed, in that case, thoughts similar to what you just expressed, Judge Arnotto, about, you know, this shouldn't have happened, and we're not excusing it, but it didn't meet the 1927 standard for sanctions, and that's what it ultimately comes down to. Now,
So I'm looking at your opposition to the decertification motion, and I see a request to substitute in a new class member, but I'm not seeing where you asked to change the date of her purchase.
I believe, Your Honor, Judge Kress pointed out, it is in a couple sentences, either in the opposition, I believe in the opposition to motion to decertify.
I'm looking. I mean, it says, as part of the clarification, this is in a lengthy brief, 22-page brief.
What page?
APP 133. As part of the clarification, plaintiffs should be granted leave to amend the complaint to reflect the narrow class, either by adding allegations pertaining to the substitute class representative or to Ms. Golikoff's in-store purchases, as detailed in her past declaration. Then it cites some just legal standards. But there's no motion. And even after the district court then granted the motion to decertify the class, and before the sanctions proceedings, there was still no motion filed to amend the complaint, even after that.
That's right, Your Honor, but it still was error to find the 1927 sanction standard met, regardless of...
Well, we're here on, you know, the district court gets some deference in sanctions, and then on top of that, we're here on mandamus. So there's sort of two layers of deference, if you will, that apply at this point. And you're looking at a case where there was an initial incorrect allegation, and then it persisted for some time in the litigation, especially once the district court issues its ruling on the arbitration motion and says very clearly, you know, this is just not in front of me because it wasn't pled in the complaint. It's hard to see what more notice needed to be given at that point.
It persisted based on true facts, only true facts after that, Your Honor, on the in-store.
But there were no true facts pled. I mean, on true operative facts, key facts. This is the whole case turns on the purchase. There's no pleading that says I purchased these in a Walmart store, physical Walmart store, that supported.
Pleadings didn't say that, but the interrogatory response did. Ms. Golikoff attached declarations to oppositions to these motions explaining she did. The facts were in the record, and petitioners had a good faith basis to argue we should proceed based on these in-store purchases. They did eventually ask to amend. I understand Your Honor's point. That wasn't a proper way to amend, but it's about their subjective mental state, whether it was reckless, bad faith. It was not, because they persisted based on facts that were true and supported non-arbitrable claims under this court's directly on-point case in Johnson versus Walmart. Wasn't subjective bad faith. Now, let me address...
You mentioned Ms. Golikoff has no intention of arbitrating this case. So why hasn't it been dismissed?
We can't under... We cite this case in the reply, I believe, Your Honor. When you dismiss a case with prejudice after a motion to compel arbitration... This court has held in the past that does not create appellate jurisdiction.
Oh, well, okay. So the case is being kept alive solely so the lawyers can appeal their sanctions?
Well, it's being kept alive during the pendency of this mandamus petition, Your Honor.
A conflict. It seems like Ms. Golikoff just wants this out of her life, wants to go on and not be a litigant anymore, but the lawyers aren't dismissing it because they want to have their sanctions reversed, and that's the only thing keeping this case alive.
Yeah, there's currently no burden on Ms. Golikoff in this case. Nothing's happening in the case. The sanctions order has stayed pending this appeal.
Well, but you said she's done with it. She's washed her hands. She has no intention of arbitrating. It's not worth her time. She's still a litigant in court, and she doesn't want to be, it sounds like, but her client, her lawyers are keeping it alive because they have their own separate fees issue, their sanctions issue. Is that right?
No, I don't think that's right. I think Ms. Golikoff is completely okay with the status. She's not being burdened by this case. And she, of course, disagrees that this case was frivolous. It was based on, you know, she had in-store purchases and supported non-arbitrable claims. I don't think that's right, Your Honor. Let's talk about Mr. Right,
you wanted to save some time for rebuttal, and we've taken you quite a bit over with questions, so I'll give you your 4 minutes, but I think We should hear from the other side now.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. All right, we'll hear now from Ms. Miller.
Good morning, Your Honors, and please the court. May it please the court. I'm Teal Miller on behalf of Real Party and Interest, Walmart, Inc. Mandamus is an extraordinary remedy. This is an ordinary sanctioned dispute that is reviewable after final judgment, so mandamus should not issue.
Well, it doesn't seem like there's any scenario in which there will be a final judgment. A dismissal without prejudice is non-appealable. We've held that many times. And there'll never be a merits arbitration judgment because she's not going to go forward with the arbitration. That's undisputed. So it's not going to happen. There will be no... I mean, it's theoretically possible, but it will not occur. Do we just rely on theory for purposes of whether this is, curable on final appeal?
I don't think it's only theoretically possible. The most recent thing in the record is docket 102 in the district court, which is a joint status report by the parties from December. The court asked for periodic status reports about the arbitration while the arbitration was stayed, saying plaintiffs had not yet decided whether to arbitrate. So we have an argument from
that
the
has now been decided because it's been represented to a federal court of appeals that it will not be pursued.
Well, I don't think
maybe they need to say that in the next status report.
So, Your Honor, I think we don't have anything from in the record from the plaintiff about whether she is. We have nothing in the record that suggests she's unwilling to arbitrate. We have argument from counsel that she prefers not to. In Cunningham, which is a Supreme Court case about sanctions against an attorney, the situation in that case, the attorney had actually been removed as criminal counsel and wanted to pursue an appeal from a sanctions order under 1292B. And the court said it wasn't reviewable, even though counsel no longer represented the client, because the court assumes unity of interest between client and attorney based on an attorney's ethical duty. So I don't think there's any basis here to assume that there's a conflict between Ms. Golikoff and her counsel. And I think the right way to see this case is that it will be appealable once they pursue arbitration and it's finalized. And this court's decision in Sanford says that collateral issues like a sanction arising out of litigation prior to a motion to compel arbitration is reviewable on appeal once you come back and either confirm the arbitration award or contest it.
So does she have to actually pursue the arbitration in order to generate a final judgment?
I think so, although I think it could be as simple as filing for arbitration and then conceding the claim. And I don't actually think that the cases cited in the reply brief about not manufacturing appellate jurisdiction actually apply here, because those are about evading the federal arbitration. That's the sort of like lack of parallelism in the Federal Arbitration Act for an appeal from a motion to compel arbitration versus an appeal from a motion denying arbitration. And what the court said there is you can't just seek dismissal in federal court and then appeal from that in order to evade that lack of parallelism in the Federal Arbitration Act. But that doesn't mean if you go to arbitration and sort of concede your case and then come back and say, we would like to confirm the arbitration award and appeal from it because of this collateral issue, you can't. So there is a direct appeal available here. And there's nothing in the record, actually, like no declaration from Golikoff saying, I won't pursue the appeal. So this is just an argument from counsel. I think this court actually should look formally at what's before it in terms of any potential conflict and conclude that there isn't one.
So in the motion on the request to decertify the class, did the district court address the issue that had been raised about leave to amend?
The court did not, because it wasn't a formal motion.
Right, but sometimes people say things in briefs and the court addresses them anyway.
No, the
and
court
I was wondering
didn't.
Whether that had happened in this case.
Yeah, it didn't here. There's something really significant in that order, though, that I want to call to the court's attention, because I think it supports our position, which is that the 1927 order was well within the court's discretion here. At page SER 111, the court made a finding, and this is about sort of the course of conduct before the opposition to the motion to compel arbitration. It said, plaintiff was always bound by an arbitration agreement and class action waiver and simply hid that fact from the court until after the class had been certified. What the court was finding was that this was, she gained advantage.
Well, suppose as soon as the error was discovered, they had immediately filed a proper formal motion to amend the complaint, and they did belt and suspenders, and they add, you know, John Doe as an additional one who has this online, this in-store purchase, and they drop the November 14th online purchase, and they put in, you know, September 10th, I went to, you know, the Walmart in, you know, Monrovia and purchased one there.
So then,
would that have solved this problem and then it all goes forward?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that the district court's finding was clear error.
Well, but it does, if that would have completely solved the problem, it does call into question. I mean, the district court characterized this action as frivolous. And it seems that under our case law, that is a load-bearing element, that it be frivolous. But the case was not frivolous. It was messed up, technically improper, but fixable. How can something that is so readily fixable be frivolous, and then you give $600,000 in sanctions just because the lawyer didn't file a formal motion to amend the complaint?
So a couple of responses. I mean, the first one is we're on mandamus here. So they have to show a clear and indisputable abuse of discretion in finding that that was frivolous. The second is, I think frivolousness in this context, if you look at this court's decision in Inri Girardi and this court's decision in Caputo, is what the court says is either we have bad faith or we have recklessness plus frivolousness. And in this context, frivolousness has included making a false allegation, continuing to rely on a false allegation, or continuing to litigate based on a clearly unavailable premise, making arguments that just are untenable. And here they did that.
I mean, but it really seems to come down to they didn't say, Mother, may I? They didn't do the right way of asking for to get everything fixed. You concede that it would have entirely fixed the problem, and we're going to call this frivolous. I thought frivolous means it's just utterly lacking in merit, unfixable.
So in the motion to dismiss context, for sure frivolous means that. In this context, on the cases, like a false allegation actually is the kind of frivolousness that coupled with recklessness satisfies 1927. But my answer that yes, that would have fixed the problem isn't a concession that they could have fixed the problem that way. I think there are hints in the record that they couldn't have. The first is that they didn't. And this court decides the case based on what actually happened, not what they say they could have happened. I also think if you look at page 152 of our excerpts, she says there was only one online purchase and all her other purchases were in store. At page 99 of their appendix, Walmart affiant says once we got her account information and were able to search whether purchases were online or in store, we identified 11 online purchases. So I think there's some question about, you know, I can't say that there's anything in the record. I can't say that they couldn't have done this. I can't show you that. But I think it matters that they haven't.
Well, are you aware, did the plaintiffs ever present any evidence of a non-online purchase other than her statement?
Like, no.
They never produced a receipt or anything else?
No, and she says in a declaration that she's not in the habit of keeping receipts. But when they
No credit card purchase or anything like that? No credit card records that would have shown that?
No, there's nothing in the record. The only receipt in the record is the one that, you know, has online circled.
What concerns me is I can possibly get when you file the complaint there was incredible sloppiness but then there was a point where you had an opportunity to fix it and they didn't. They kept saying, oh, we can take our word for it. She bought in a physical store, never stepped up with an amendment, never stepped up with a request to amend, never stepped up with any proof for it to amend, and basically just saying, trust us, we can do it, but never actually stepped up to the mark. Is that fair?
That's fair. And then I would say in addition to that, it wasn't just the amended complaint and the first amended complaint. There's a whole course of conduct here. And this court's cases about 1927 say you look at the course of conduct in order to determine when you're reviewing a 1927 order. And the course of conduct starts with the opposition to the motion to dismiss, which cites the price of the bottle of olive oil, or avocado oil, I apologize, that she purchased, and says $8.23, which is the number from the receipt, which means that at best they missed another opportunity to fix this error.
This is what I'm trying to kind of get at, because subjective bad faith, that is the standard, seems to me like it kind of kicks in a little bit, a lot later in the case. Doesn't go back necessarily to day one, but definitely goes back to when Walmart said, look, you have a problem here. But I think the district court awarded fees earlier than that, and I'm not sure that was within the scope.
Well, a couple of answers. It's the standard is recklessness plus frivolousness or subjective bad faith, and the district court said, you know, it was the first that it was imposing sanctions for. I just gave you an example of something that happened between the filing of the first amended complaint, which is sort of the first moment at which it becomes subject to 1927 sections, because it's 27 sanctions, because it's not the complaint itself. And that's in the motion to dismiss, where they cite the receipt again, and a missed opportunity to correct the record and say to the court, our allegation is false. Then, as you say, once we get to the opposition to the motion to compel arbitration, a whole bunch of things happen that are at best reckless. They claimed in that opposition that now they say this was simply a mistake. At the time, when they were opposing the motion to compel arbitration, they said, this wasn't a mistake. Our complaint is accurate. It's consistent with an online purchase. And in fact, Walmart should have understood that and has waived arbitration by not understanding it. So they tried to take advantage of the false allegations in the opposition to the motion to compel opposition.
Do you read the district court as relying on this piece in awarding the sanctions?
Absolutely. I think that's what the district court meant when it said at page 5 of the appendix, after it was revealed that plaintiffs purchased the avocado oil online instead of in a Walmart store, rather than correcting the error, plaintiff continued to advance her litigation position through the opposition to the motion to compel arbitration and in opposition to a motion to decertify. Well,
to me, that's where the subjective bad faith really starts. I don't know if before that, I mean, it's just sloppiness and poor lawyering, but I'm not sure that it's subjective bad faith up to that point. Tell me why it is.
So, two responses to that. The first is, it is because there were at least two opportunities to check this receipt again that were missed. And it's more than sloppiness, because under Townsend, we assess, which is sort of looks at a lawyer's duty to check an allegation. We look at the particular allegation, its significance to the case, and how, like, whether the lawyer could have checked it. Here, it was easy as pie to check it. The receipt was there, and it was critical to their case. And so it's more than sloppiness because of the nature of this allegation. Sure, there are allegations, there are statements in a complaint that would just be sloppy. But I'm saying this is reckless because of its significance and because it was the way they got the class certified, which gives them the hammer in a class action case.
How about just the sheer amount of the sanctions? Because I have a feeling that if the sanctions were $20,000, that we might not be here, but it's $600,000.
It was expensive because it was a class action. That's sort of the model of litigation they were pursuing. We went through a motion to dismiss, the class certification, and then the opposition to the motion to compel arbitration. All of those things are expensive. But that's not a basis for mandamus. That's reviewable on direct appeal. And it's as a result of their litigation choices. The amount of the sanctions doesn't make it mandamusable if it otherwise wouldn't have been or show a clear and indisputable error.
Suppose we think it otherwise, we get to the merits, then why isn't the number excessive, and why shouldn't some pieces of it, as Judge Donato has raised questions about, might be separated out?
They haven't in their briefs said, okay, fine, they don't need to make a concession in order to make this argument in the alternative. They haven't made the argument in the alternative that nothing before the opposition to the motion to compel arbitration was sanctionable. They haven't asked you to look at the case this way. I see that my time is almost up. I just want to point out there's one more significant finding from the district court, which is at SER 79, where he found that their argument that won't, that they're pleading was consistent, was honest, was consistent, was with an online allegation, was, quote, unreasonable. I've pointed out their argument that sort of Walmart screwed up by trusting them, and how that's reckless. But I also want to just make one more point, which is that Lyon says that he didn't realize this until it was called to his attention by Walmart's counsel on April 24th of 2025. But the record shows he knew it at least a week earlier when he filed Golikoff's response to interrogatories saying it was an online purchase. So that calls into question their characterization that this was a mistake. It also calls into question the fact that they're now saying it was a mistake, and at first they said this wasn't an error at all. It was accurate, and Walmart should have known and waived arbitration by not opposing it. Calls into question their current position on what happened here. If the court has no further questions,
all right. Thank
we
you,
ask that mandamus be denied.
All right. Thank you. We'll hear rebuttal. I raised the question whether this was fixable, but the question whether it's fixable really required some factual predicate, which is that here's the other person, here's the alternative date, and that isn't in the record, is it?
Here's the other purchase, you mean, Your Honor?
In other words, I asked counsel whether when the error was discovered, it was fixable by an amended complaint that would have allowed the action to go forward as originally intended and as everyone expected it would go forward. And you put two methods of doing that in the opposition to the motion to decertify. One was that you could add another plaintiff with an in-store purchase, and the other is that she could continue to go forward and maybe you would substitute an in-store purchase as to her. But there was no factual predicate. It was just asserted. But it wasn't, here's a complaint, here are the dates, here's the person. There was never any factual predicate. So how can we even reach the conclusion that you established that this was fixable when it's not in the record anywhere?
As I understand it, Your Honor, the way to potentially fix this for Ms. Golikoff was to amend, and Walmart's counsel agreed that would have fixed it.
Right, but then counsel also said, not clear there's a factual basis, because we put in at, you know, I think she said at RA99, we put in and said she's done 11 online purchases of this product. So maybe she's never done one. And then silence in response. Am I right? There's nothing in response to that actually here is the, you know, here's some facts to say there's a specific purchase on a specific date.
It's routine for consumers not to have purchases for receipts for in-store purchases. This court recognized that.
Right, but Judge, you say, well, here's a Walmart store purchase on my credit card receipt. I don't have the detail of what I bought there, but I have that, and I went to a Walmart store on this date, and I can tell you now that I remember that I bought the avocado oil that day.
Or amending the complaint, the plaintiff's testimony that they bought it is routinely more than enough, especially for in-store purchases when receipts aren't common. That goes directly to vexatious multiplication, because if petitioners had done as Your Honor said they absolutely should have and immediately said, whoops, this is wrong, when they knew it before the ARB motion and moved to amend, everything would have still proceeded and more. Walmart would still be litigating this case and would have spent more money. This mistake caused Walmart to win in a way it's not clear they would have won if petitioners had fixed it right away and moved to amend, as Your Honors suggested they should have. It goes to frivolousness, Judge, as you pointed out, and it also goes to vexatious multiplication of proceedings. The sanctions need to be for conduct that causes, you know, Walmart to incur these fees, and you have to look at the alternative world, what would have happened if petitioners had done as Your Honor said they should have and moved to amend.
How about when you're opposing the arbitration and you're saying, well, from a store, that could mean from a Walmart store, that could mean an online store, and you know Walmart should have figured this out on its own. I mean, how do you support those arguments? And the district court clearly rejected them.
That was a weak argument that the district court rejected, but it wasn't an argument that asserted false facts. petitioners told the truth in that. They said she bought in store. This was wrong, but Walmart reasonably should have figured this out beforehand. An unpersuasive argument rejected is not basis for 1927 sanctions.
And so in opposing arbitration, the lawyers did not submit a declaration from Ms. Golikov saying, I attest to these in-store purchases, did they?
I believe they did, Your Honor.
You're sure about that?
They certainly did in response to the
motion. A declaration by her, by the plaintiff.
Certification.
Saying not decertification, an opposition to arbitration. Did they submit a declaration saying, I attest to the following, and gave dates and some information?
Let me check that, Your Honor. It would have been attached to that if it was submitted.
Well, I think there was something submitted in opposition to the motion to compel, right? That yes. Said I have purchased.
I believe that's correct.
I have purchased from both online and physical Walmart stores.
Yes, it's Appendix 90.
But with no dates.
No dates. Or anything.
It didn't have dates because she doesn't recall the exact dates of her in-store purchases. But it gives the. It says it was during the class period.
Just one last question for me. Do you represent Cho and Lyon, or do you also represent Golikov?
Say that again, Your Honor.
Do you represent just Cho and Lyon, or do you also represent Golikov?
Just Cho and Lyon, Your Honor.
So you do not represent Ms. Golikov.
I do not.
So you cannot speak on her behalf here today.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
But are you not, is your firm not representing?
My firm represents Ms. Golikov, but I didn't appear in the underlying case. I'm here on behalf of Ms. Cho and Ms. Lyon, is my understanding.
Right, but you're all lawyers at the same firm, right?
We are, Your Honor. Yes, we are. The second key point I wanted to address that goes to Judge Nonato's point, we absolutely did argue that you cannot sanction petitioners for conduct related to the complaint because, although it may be sloppy, it was not reckless.
Right.
But so that argument was made, and that
was the first document, but did you, I mean, Ms. Miller's has indicated, and there's some force to the argument that you didn't really parse up the amount of the fees and say this part here should not go. And
that follows directly logically from our argument on the merits, which is if you can't sanction petitioners for conduct up to point A, then
right.
you have to.
It's all or nothing. You didn't really make a, well, if I could lose, but the sanctions amount should be reduced.
No, Your Honor, I think we did because we said you cannot sanction petitioners for conduct from period A to B. And that means you can't impose fees for conduct from A to B. It can't be the case. You can impose fees for conduct that's not sanctionable under the 1927 standard. That has to be true.
Yeah. All right. I've let you go quite a bit over, and so the case just argued will be submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. At this point, the court will take a 5-minute recess.